Welcome to Whiskey Cast, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 424 for May 12th, 2013. Coming up in a few minutes.
Right now, we're laying down about two casks a week, and we're doing that without really killing ourselves.
I was in Toronto this weekend for the annual Spirit of Toronto Festival and caught up with Barry Steen and Barry Bernstein. We first met them on WhiskeyCast back in October of 2006, when they were just getting started as independent bottlers and dreaming of opening a distillery. They did that, and 2 weeks ago they released the first Ontario single malt whiskey, Stock and Barrel. We'll hear more from them later on WhiskeyCast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department, all on this week's episode of WhiskeyCast.
WhiskeyCast, proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Let's start off with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. We'll start off with the business side of things first. Diageo CEO Paul Walsh has announced his plans to step aside at the end of next month. His top lieutenant, Chief Operating Officer Ivan Menezes, will become the new CEO of the world's largest whiskey maker. Walsh will remain with the company for a year to help with the transition, but he'll step down from Diageo's board in September and retire completely at the end of June 2014. By the way, according to The Independent, the new boss's favorite drink is Johnny Walker Black Label with ice and soda. One other management move to mention this week, Graham Bowie has left Bal Blair Distillery, where he was assistant manager under John McDonald. He's going to become the first manager of Adelphi's new Ardna Merkin Distillery, which is now under construction. Graham will oversee construction work at the site until the stills are ready to be fired up. That's expected to be in December. One of the questions surrounding last year's acquisition of Brooke Laddie by Remy Cointreau was the future of Murray McDavid, the independent bottling line that was rolled into Brooke Laddie when Mark Rainier's investment group bought the distillery in 2000. The future of Murray McDavid became much clearer this past week. The brand has been sold to ACO Limited. It's a company you've probably never heard of, but is well known within the Scotch whiskey industry. It manages privately owned casks of whiskey and owns its own inventory of casks, along with providing blending and logistics services. The announcement indicated that Murray McDavid will be run independently of ACO by managers who've been involved with the brand in the past. Word is that at least one Brooke Laddie sales manager is moving with the brand to do just that. Another Australian whiskey is headed for the export market. ABC News in Australia reports Tasmania's Nant Distillery will become a publicly traded company with plans to establish its own chain of whiskey bars around the world. Nant already has bars featuring its own whiskeys as well as other Tasmanian whiskeys and products in Hobart and Brisbane, and will have two more open in Australia later this year. Lots of new whiskeys to talk about this week. While I was in Toronto, I ran into Angela Forsgren-Durazio of Macmira. The latest edition of the Moments series is coming out, but she told me that number 10 will be the final one in that series.
Any new kind of limited editions will come, of course, after this one, but this series is ending with number 10.
And tell me about number 10, because it is, as you say, the last of the series. So I assume you've come up with something pretty special.
So number 10 is something that I played with last year when I was developing our whiskey honey liqueur. I was playing with some freshly roasted coffee beans, espresso coffee beans, and I was throwing them into whiskey, and I just realized that that was a very good harmony in the coffee and the whiskey together. So that's what I did. I did some coffee whiskey with the espresso beans, and then I took that coffee whiskey. That was simple. It was just macerating the coffee beans in some very good mature whiskey for some hours. And then I took that coffee whiskey. I took out the beans and I took the coffee whiskey, and I seasoned some casks with it for a couple of weeks. So I gave taste of that coffee whiskey to the casks, and then I took out the coffee whiskey and I used it for my honey whiskey liqueur. And I took those casks, fresh new American oak casks, and I put some real whiskey on it, and that's the Special 010.
She's finishing up a smoky single malt that will be released later this year. While the Final Moments edition will be available in McMirra's export markets, the smoky malt will only be out in Sweden. Also on the single malt front, Jura is making some changes to its core range, but it's leaving the whiskies alone. The Jura 10 will now be known as Jura Origin, the 12-year-old as Jura Elixir, and the 16-year-old as Jura Jurox Own. Jurox is the Gaelic word for the residents of Jura. All three whiskies also get new packaging. By the way, there will also be a new 40-year-old release from Jura down the road. People who attend the Jura Whiskey Festival on the Isle at the end of May will get a chance to taste it, even though it's only 39 and a half years old now. Back to Toronto, and as you might expect, there's news on Canadian whiskies to report. John Hall of 40 Creek's latest whiskey is called Copper Pot Reserve, and he also gave us a preview of his annual limited edition release that will be out later this year.
A lot of people describe it as 40 Creek Barrel Select on steroids. Now, the reason why is because it has more rye in it. It's at a higher alcohol level. It's at 43%. The rye is older rye, so you're getting a lot of spice explosion in this particular taste expression. And the extra alcohol, the extra 3 percentage points of alcohol are really needed there to help balance it off. But again, very complex, very full-bodied, but very smooth finish. It's just taken off. I'm planning on introducing it to the United States this fall. It'll be coming out because it was first introduced in my home province of Ontario. And because it's been so successful, I can now roll it out to other markets.
And that'll be followed by your annual special release this fall as well, right?
Oh, yes. I'm very excited about this year's release. Everyone's been asking me about it. The release is called 40 Creek Heart of Gold. And the reason why it's called Heart of Gold is because I was working on this almost a decade. And what I did, it's very rye forward. There's a little bit of corn, a little bit of barley whiskey to help balance it off and give it some fullness, but it's mainly rye. And what I was trying to do with the rye was a lot of people can capture the spice and the fruitiness of the rye, but rye also has a lot of floral aromas, and they usually get lost. And I really wanted to capture those floral notes of the rye. So what I did was I fermented the rye with a wine yeast, because wine yeast tends to be more floral, so it'll bring that out and capture some of the florals in the rye. And then what I did a very tight cut on the heart so that I wouldn't lose those floral notes and just capture the spice. Now, I do still capture spice and I still capture fruit from it, but the big star is the floral aromas. And there's all kinds of aromas in there. There's rose hips, you got orange blossoms. There's all sorts of different aromas in there. And again, it's this one is drier but you still know that it's coming from 40 Creek.
And it'll be available this fall in very limited amounts, and you pretty much have to reserve it ahead of time, right?
Absolutely. There's 9,000 bottles. That's all there is. It might sound like a lot, but it's not a lot of whiskey. I've allocated it across Canada, and I've also allocated some for the United States.
And available September, October time period?
Yes. In Canada, the release date is about mid-September. And in the U.S., it should be out, I would say, by October.
I have samples of both whiskeys. I'll have tasting notes for them available soon. Also on the Canadian front, Corby is expanding availability for its Lot 40 and Pike Creek whiskeys outside of Canada. Corby master blender Don Livermore worked on both. Pike Creek is already out in the U.S., and Lot 40 is on the way.
Lot 40 will be coming into the U.S. probably close to September. I know the bottling date is occurring shortly, and we should probably start seeing it going into select states about that time.
Now, both Pike Creek and Lot number 40 are part of resurrecting an old collection that you guys used to have, right?
That's correct. It was first pioneered by the previous master blender, Mike Booth, and it's become a little bit of a renaissance right now, the rye whiskey. So we thought it was time to bring in the Lot 40 back to the marketplace when premiumization of Canadian whiskeys are becoming more and more popular.
And Lot number 40 is a high rye content whiskey, right?
Yeah, Lot 40, the whiskey is 100% rye. It's my ingredient that I would use to bring the rye flavoring to most Canadian whiskeys. So I effectively would call it, be like a single malt is to Scotland. And it's rye. That's what the Canadians do.
There's word that an export version of Corby's flagship Weiser's Canadian whiskey will be out later this year. I'll have more details as they're available. Now, Masterson's rye is Canadian, but it's actually bottled by 35 Maple Street in California. And the whiskey has been winning awards on both sides of the border. There are two new Masterson's expressions on the way, and Richard Zeller of 35 Maple Street isn't stopping there.
We're coming out with a 12-year-old, 100% straight wheat whiskey, and we're also coming out with a Masterson's 10-year-old barley, which will also be 100% barley. And then next year, we're coming out with, actually maybe even later on this year, we're coming out with a small batch Tennessee bourbon, 8-year-old small batch Tennessee bourbon, which is going to be called Bibb and Tucker. And if you don't know what a Bibb and Tucker is, a Bibb and Tucker in the Western days was your Sunday's finest clothing. You put on a Bibb and Tucker. So we're looking forward to all three of those new offerings.
Where are you sourcing the Tennessee whiskey from?
Oh, I can't tell you that. I can't tell you. I wish I could, but I've been sworn, unfortunately, to secrecy. I'm sure you could imagine, but I can't tell you.
Well, there's only two places it can come from, realistically. Two, maybe three at most. But when will it be out? And tell me what you can about it.
Well, it'll be out for sure in 2014. Possibly out in 2013. What we're working on now is the glass design. It's going to be in an amber cartouche glass that we're sourcing the amber glass. It's not going to be a painted bottle. It's going to be a real special mold. It'll be really a work of art. The bourbon is a work of art, and the packaging will be as well. That's about all I could tell you. You're actually the first person I'm talking to really about it with the press.
Back to the wheat and the barley whiskeys for a moment. Are those going to be Canadian as well as your existing Masterson's rye?
They are. Our Masterson's program is a Canadian program. Both the wheat and the barley are also being sourced out of Alberta as well.
Any chance you guys might set up your own distillery at some point?
We're working on it now. Absolutely working on it as we speak.
Would it be located in Alberta? Would it be in California? Where would you guys put it?
Most likely it would be in California. It wouldn't be in Alberta. It would be in California. But that doesn't mean we won't be sourcing our Masterson's from. Our Masterson's is a Canadian project, and we intend on keeping it as a Canadian project. But we have other things in the works that might, you know, come out of California or come out of somewhere in the U.S.
Zeller called Bibb and Tucker a Tennessee bourbon, and as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, that is not an oxymoron. Technically, there's no difference between Tennessee whiskeys and bourbons except for the use of the Lincoln County charcoal filtering process, and there's nothing that says a Tennessee whiskey can't be called a bourbon. One other bit of discussion that was making waves around the event Saturday night in Toronto. And it wasn't the theft of that Glenfiddich 50-year-old from a Liquor Control Board of Ontario store in Toronto last month. Whiskey lovers in Ontario are stocking up this week. The LCBO is in a contract dispute with the union representing its 7,000 employees. There's a strike deadline this coming Friday. The two sides are nowhere close to an agreement. And there's also a 3-day holiday weekend coming up with Victoria Day on Monday. Now, what makes this important outside of Ontario? Well, for years, the LCBO has been the world's largest single buyer of wines and spirits, and a prolonged strike could have an impact on whiskey producers. Let's head south now to Kentucky, where a new stop has been added to the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, even though it won't officially open until this fall. Heaven Hill's new Evan Williams Bourbon Experience is still under construction on Main Street in downtown Louisville. but it will become the eighth stop on the Bourbon Trail. And since Louisville is generally the jumping-off point for visitors who fly into Kentucky, that effectively makes it the starting point on the Bourbon Trail. Kentucky Distillers Association President Eric Gregory says the new addition is just what the Bourbon Trail needed.
This has kind of been the missing link and something we've been waiting for years to happen, you know, especially since Lexington was added last year with the Town Branch Distillery. A lot of people use Louisville as their launching point for our Kentucky Bourbon Trail adventure because of all the things they have to offer there. They've got fantastic restaurants, great hotels, and just a lot of other amenities and attractions like the Louisville Slugger Museum and much more. So to have a Kentucky Bourbon Trail distillery stop right in the middle of the heart of downtown Louisville on Whiskey Row to offer a really immersive experience is just a fantastic news. We couldn't be prouder today. You can't see it, but I'm smiling as wide as possible.
And this really won't even open for a few more months yet, but it's going to be really something unusual for downtown, right?
It will. You know, there have been a lot of distilleries planned and announced, craft distilleries for downtown. This one will open in October, and you know, hopefully someday we will have a number of distilleries down there that visitors who are in town for a convention or something and may not be able to rent a car or go out and visit some of our larger facilities can come downtown and get a taste of what a distillery does and what life on Whiskey Row back, you know, hundreds of years ago was, and see what bourbon means to Kentucky these days.
And for people who don't know what Whiskey Row meant on Main Street back in the day, give me a sense of the history of this location.
Whiskey Row in downtown Louisville, right on Main Street, was the hub of Kentucky's bustling distillery industry before Prohibition. There weren't distilleries down there per se, but this is where your offices were, or where, you know, you had a lot of warehouses a couple streets over. You had places where bourbon was being shipped out in the Louisville port. You know, it has such great history. A lot of the buildings, thankfully, have survived and are being restored and renovated. And with the bourbon renaissance that's going on right now, it's something that we think will be a major tourism attraction to not only add to what Louisville's got already there, but to keep people in town a couple extra days.
And this is really right in the center of the tourist district because it's right down the street from the Performing Arts Center, right up the street from the Louisville Slugger Museum.
Fraser Arts Museum. Yes.
A couple of blocks away from the 21C Hotel and all the major downtown hotels too, right?
It is. I mean, you're within walking distance. Some of the best hotels, the best restaurants, the Center for Performing Arts is right across the street. The Fraser Museum, Louisville Slugger Museum on one end, Louisville Slugger Field, where the minor league team for the Reds plays on the other end. It's a great hospitality section of Louisville, and we think this will just only enhance the visitor experience.
Tell me what's expected on the Bourbon Trail this year as far as visitors. Last year you had more than 500,000. I'm assuming that you're going to have more this year.
Yeah, we've already been working with the distilleries and figuring out where everybody is first quarter, and most distilleries are already saying that they're double-digit growth through the first quarter, some 20-25% up over last year. If projections hold out, just based on the most conservative of estimates, we could be seeing upwards of 800,000 people by 2016. It's one of those things where we keep on thinking, boy, it's going to slow down sometime soon, right? And it hasn't, which is great. And our distilleries have really been making a lot of investments to their visitor centers and their properties to kind of catch up with this, with all these new visitors coming to Kentucky. And adding another distillery stop, I think, will give people more options. And, you know, and with a lot of craft distilleries now coming on board as well, we could probably have two or three more craft distilleries join our Kentucky Bourbon Trail Craft Tour by the end of the year. So people really have a lot of ways to learn more about bourbon tourism and bourbon's history and heritage in Kentucky than ever before.
By the way, Eric mentioned that Louisville Mayor Greg Fisher has collected on his bets from the University of Louisville's NCAA basketball championship. He won stakes from Wichita's mayor when the Cardinals beat Wichita State in the semifinals, and 10 bottles of California Cabernet Sauvignon from Berkeley's mayor when Louisville's women's team beat Cal in the women's Final Four. Turns out the steaks and wine will be auctioned off for charity, along with the two fully stocked bourbon bars the KDA put up for Fisher's half of the bets. On that note, Louisville men's coach Rick Pitino will be getting his face on a Maker's Mark bottle. The commemorative bottle will celebrate the Louisville championship, as well as Pitino's induction into the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame on Final Four weekend. 12,600 bottles will be available, with the proceeds to help support a new academic center for the university's athletics program. It's the second time Pitino has appeared on a Maker's Mark bottle. He was on a bottle produced in 2002 that raised money for the Boy Scouts in Kentucky. By the way, you can see the label for this year's Pitino bottle in the news section at WhiskeyCast.com. That's also where you can keep up with whiskey news all week long. But for now, that's the latest news.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Help us select the next Glenmorangie single malt whiskey with the Glenmorangie Cask Masters project. Sign up online through the Glenmorangie Facebook page or on glenmorangie.com.
Just a reminder, our Father's Day sale is underway in the WhiskeyCast Photo Gallery now through June 16th. You'll get 15% off every print in the gallery, and you don't need any of those promo codes. Just add a print to the cart, you'll see the discount automatically when you check out. The deadline to order prints in time for Father's Day delivery is May 20th for international orders, May 31st for North American orders, and you'll find the gallery in the pub section of the WhiskeyCast website. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker. Once again, I had a great time in Toronto this weekend, thanks to everyone who stopped me to say hello, as well as the full room of folks at my tasting session Saturday night. I decided to combine photography and whiskey that night, showing off some photos from some of the distilleries I've visited while tasting whiskeys from those distilleries. We tasted whiskeys from Highland Park, Cavalan, Amrut, and Wyoming Whiskey, as well as the new Tweedale Blended Scotch that will be out later this month. And I pulled out a special bottle of Balcones Cooked Whiskey out of the bag at the end of the session. Charles Thibodeau and Francois Côté came over from Quebec for the evening, and Charles posted this note on our Facebook page. It was great to finally meet you, Mark, after all the time that I've been listening to you. I also enjoyed the masterclass very much. My wife, Alexandra Capone, says hello. Cheers. Now, I need to explain this for a second. Charles and Francois sat together in the front row, and Charles was on the phone talking to his wife and trying to tell her that he was in the room with me. She apparently wasn't buying it, so he handed the phone to me. I said hello, and I heard, "Is this Ralphie?" You see, our buddy Ralphie Mitchell was also in Toronto doing some tastings that night, along with Charlie McLean, and I think there was some confusion there. Eric Gingras also attended the class. He posted this note. Pleasure to meet you, Mark, and the class was great. Thank you for giving us the chance to taste the Tweedale blend, the Wyoming Whiskey Bourbon, and the Balcones 62% Cooked Bourbon. Eric, I'm glad you had a good time as well. Now, earlier in the week, I posted a link to one of the blog posts on Davin DeKergamo's excellent CanadianWhiskey.org site, in which he blasted Whistlepig for minimizing its Canadian roots and trying to pass itself off as a distiller at some recent events. While there were several excellent comments, I wanted to give Tyler Allison some credit. His line on the Facebook page, and I'm quoting now, "I thought Canada was part of the United States, runs and hides, but I agree, it's great rye. I don't care where they make it, just don't stop." End quote. You see, of course, the greatest insult that one can give a Canadian is to imply that Canada is part of the United States. Of course it's not. Now, if you'd like to start an international incident, go visit another website. But if there's something you'd like to share with whiskey lovers around the world, you can always post it on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com or on our Facebook page, and you can also email me. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com, and Your Voice is brought to you this week by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Nichols and Perks in Stourbridge, England will have a tasting of Irish Distillers whiskies May 17th. There are a number of tastings around the world for World Whiskey Day on the 18th. You'll find a list of them at WhiskeyCast.com. The New York Indie Spirits Expo for craft distillers is on May 21st. Sam Snead's House of Whiskey in Auckland, New Zealand will have an old malt cask tasting May 22nd. Springbank's annual open day at the distillery is May 23rd. And, of course, the Isla Festival of Malt and Music, Fagiel, gets underway May 24th and runs through June 1st. Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts will have an Ardbog Day tasting May 29th. And that same day, the Whiskey Shop in Auckland, New Zealand will have what's being called just an extremely old whiskey tasting. That one sounds interesting. You'll find more than 300 upcoming whiskey events around the world in the pub at whiskeycast.com. There's bound to be one near you. The calendar of events is brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at laphroaig.com, and while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Islay.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Kevin O'Gorman, master of maturation, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
It's the combination of two barrels together that impart a lot of the flavour for the Redbreast. You have the Oloroso sherry imparts a sort of a sherry note, a nice sweet note to the Redbreast. And then on the other side, you have the American barrel, which gives lovely toasted wood, a sort of vanilla, a bit of sweetness. And really, it's about combining these two casks together that make up the Redbreast that produces such a fantastic whiskey.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know Redbreast.
WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Back in the fall of 2006, we first met Barry Steen and Barry Bernstein in Toronto. They were whiskey lovers who decided to chuck their successful careers and get into the whiskey business. They started out as independent bottlers with the Premium Bottlers line, but always wanted to have their own distillery. In 2009, they opened Stillwaters Distillery in the Toronto suburb of Concord, and 2 weeks ago, the first bottles of Stock and Barrel Single Malt went on sale at the distillery.
We think it's wonderful. We've released three casks, two at cask strength and one at 46%. They're just over 3 years old, but we think that they're incredibly mature for youngsters.
And what did you guys learn, Barry, that helped you get this right the first time?
A lot of patience. it was a lot of trial and error to start with, and playing with the mash bill and getting ourselves right from the get-go. And as soon as we started to lay down casks and taste them, as they started to mature after 6 months, a year, we knew we had something that was going to be great.
Now, tell me what the process was for you guys from becoming an independent bottler at first, teaspooning a little Canadian whiskey in to keep the government happy, into some single casks that you'd brought over from Scotland 4 or 5 years, 6 years ago, and getting to the point now where you've actually got the distillery going. Tell me what went into that process.
The process was really, again, a trial and error type process where we started from those things that you talked about. We knew initially, even right from the get-go, that we wanted to do something in a distillery mode, but didn't want to take that leap initially. Realized after we were doing the independent bottling that we really couldn't do that to the degree that we wanted, and took the leap of faith. Got the distillery going 4 years ago, started with a vodka, a single malt vodka, which is unique and different, and then started to lay down as fast as we possibly could afford casks of single malt, rye, and corn.
And you also came out with the Canadian whiskey too as well, right?
Yeah, we came out with the Canadian whiskey. Again, we had sort of established ourselves as a distiller of vodka, but whiskey was where we wanted to be. So we thought it was necessary to get our name associated with a brown spirit and whiskey, so people knew Stillwaters meant whiskey.
But you didn't use the Stillwaters name on the single malt.
No, we didn't. our name is there, but it's small. We worked with a marketing company that did a lot of work with us, and they convinced us, and we're quite happy with the direction it went, to brand it separately, and go out with a Stock and Barrel name for our whiskey. So going forward, any whiskey we release will be under the Stock and Barrel brand, but the name of the distillery is still Stillwaters Distillery.
Where did Stock and Barrel come from? Obviously the stalks of barley, the barrels for the maturation process, but was it their idea? Was it your idea? Who signed off on it finally, or who gets the credit for this thing?
The agency we work with, the marketing firm we work with, came up with several different variations. They wanted to come with a Canadian theme, something that depicted who we are, what we are, where we came from, the roots of the product, and we finally nailed down on Stock and Barrel. We think it has a great tone to it. It looks good on the bottle, and we signed off on it. We're the ones that are ultimately responsible for it, whether it goes or not.
Well, I wanted to point out one of the things that we noticed after we had signed off on it was the S&B handmade for stock and barrel. Of course, Steen and Bernstein.
That wasn't planned at all.
Just a happy coincidence.
It just worked, yeah. And it took us a while to realize that. It shows how dumb we are, yeah.
And your wives didn't even point this out?
No. They've been smart and have kept their distance, as especially over the past 6 months as we've been working hard to get this out the door and get the packaging finalized and everything bottled. And
okay, so if you had to do this all over again, what would you do differently now that it's only been 2 weeks since it's been on the market?
Well, if we had to do it over again, I think we would have started distilling right from the beginning, as opposed to being an independent bottler. But from the two-week standpoint, nothing different. The launch went incredibly well. We basically have sold out of cask one, almost sold out of cask two, and cask three is selling quite well. So we're quite pleased. We're hoping to be in the LCBO at some point in the near future with the stock and barrel, but they missed the release date. It's the way it is. So they've indicated that they want to take a couple of casks, but it'll be later on in the maturation.
And that sounds disturbingly familiar with when you guys first came out with the initial premium bottlers releases, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the challenges here. But the good news is we've shipped a considerable amount of product down to the U.S. We're shipping out west. We'll be shipping out east as well. So from a business perspective, it doesn't matter where we sell it. As much as we'd love to sell it locally, we're happy that we're selling it.
Are you getting any tourists at the distillery yet, or is that something you're trying to do?
Yeah, absolutely. The tourist start has started to really heat up at the distillery. We're getting constant calls for people to come in and do tours, either individually or in larger groups. We recently had a group of 48 people come through the distillery, which was great. So we're really happy with that. It happens during the day, evenings, sometimes on the weekends. So we're getting to the point where we're living at the distillery, much to our wives' dismay. But it's good.
Or much to their happiness, yeah. Since it gets you guys out of the house, right?
You've met them, haven't you?
Well, I know from wives who refer to themselves as whiskey widows, sometimes it's getting the guys out of the house is a little easier, better said than done.
Exactly.
Now, are you able to sell whiskey at your distillery yet?
Yes, we are. Yeah, and in fact, over the next week or so, we will be going live selling online and delivering within Ontario as well.
So you can really sort of work around the LCBO technically, right?
Yeah, technically, although the LCBO still gets their entire proceeds from all the sales, but it doesn't matter. We're able to get our product out into consumers' hands, and that's what's important.
Now, how much are you producing, and how fast can you step up production? Where do you go from here?
Well, right now we're laying down about two casks a week, and we're doing that without really killing ourselves. We can ramp up very quickly, very easily, either with additional, fermentation tanks, or and we're looking at getting a second still already. So we really want to double our capacity and be able to lay down at least four or five casks a week in the future. So,
has this been everything you guys thought it would be?
It's been a lot more work, but certainly over the past 2 weeks, it's been very gratifying. So, yeah, we're happy. Now we're happy.
By the way, the guys aren't just limiting themselves to single malts. They're maturing a 100% rye whiskey now, along with casks of corn whiskey as well. And they're doing something that's very unusual for a distillery. They've put their entire cask inventory online with details on each individual cask that they're laying down, and allowing you to follow each one as it gets closer to bottling time. There's a link to the Stillwater's website at whiskeycast.com. And that's this week's Whiskey Cast In Depth. It's brought to you by Woodford Reserve. Discover Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, uniquely matured in two separate new white oak barrels, the second deeply toasted and lightly charred for a more complex dimensional flavor. Find out more at woodfordreserve.com. Be double sure. Drink responsibly. Woodford Reserve Double Oaked, Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, 45.2% alcohol by volume, Woodford Reserve Distillery, Versailles, Kentucky. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with the first release of Stock and Barrel Single Malt. Cask number one was a new American oak cask bottled at 63.2% ABV, and my sample had a good balance of toffee, clove, and honey notes with a hint of vanilla. The taste is chewy with a good mouthfeel and notes of butterscotch, toffee, and honey sweetness, balanced by some clove spiciness. There's a nice maltiness in the background with a dab of vanilla for a very good balance. The finish has clove spice with aromatic notes of creme brulee, butterscotch, and toasted marshmallow, and it lingers nicely. For just 3.5 years old, it's very well balanced with no obvious flaws and has a lot of promise for the future. I'm scoring Stock and Barrel Single Malt, cask number 1, an 86. I brought back some blended Scotch whiskies from my recent trip to India that you can't find in the United States. Had a chance to taste a couple of Black Dog releases from B.J. Malia's United Spirits this past week. As you might expect, there appears to be some White and Mackay influence on them. Black Dog Centenary is bottled at 42.8% ABV. The nose is spicy with ginger, hints of cinnamon and curry powder, honey, vanilla, and a touch of brandy. The taste is light, thin at first, with a maple note followed by a strong cinnamon spice that builds up quickly. Honey, vanilla, orange peel, and mango notes come out as the spiciness fades. The finish is fairly short with a lingering tartness. I'm scoring Black Dog Centenary an 84. Now, the Black Dog 12-year-old is also bottled at 42.8% ABV. The nose on this one is a bit smoother, with mild spices, ginger, cinnamon, honey, vanilla, a hint of lemon, and just a touch of oak. The taste is syrupy, with a strong cinnamon bite that builds up quickly. Honey, vanilla, and black tea with lemon notes come out as the spice fades on this one, though. And the finish lingers with those honey, black tea, and lemon notes, and just a hint of the cinnamon spiciness. I'm scoring Black Dog 12 Blended Scotch an 84. You'll find these tasting notes at the all-new WhiskeyCast.com, along with my notes and scores for nearly 1,000 different whiskeys. That's also where you'll find the pub with the latest whiskey news, the calendar of events, the Your Voice page, and the mall with the WhiskeyCast photo gallery and our bookstore powered by Amazon.com. Of course, you'll also find a completely searchable archive of past episodes, too. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Join the stillhouse at singlepotstill.com and receive an exclusive whiskey tasting journal.
Whiskey Cast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2013, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.